You are all weirdos.
Weird science is the revolution. Weird science is the revolution.
Welcome all you weirdos, lighthouse keepers traveling the world with Jumbo Carnation, and everyone whose name is written on these giant walls surrounding me. It is time for your 89th Weird Dose of X, the mutant member of your weird science family. I am your legacy host, Jason, broadcasting as always from the Wrong Turn Studio, high atop stately Weird Science Tower, and here with me is a man whose nanites are only barely kept under control by his raging techno-organic virus infection, and vice versa, is my pal Ruben. Hey Ruben, how the heck are you today?
Oh, I'm good. I'm the young version where my nanites actually don't do anything, strangely.
And I just realized that my Google speaker, when I say Ruben, thinks I'm saying Google. That's why, hang on one second. Hey Google, stop. Okay. Sorry about that, everybody. We're going to keep going. My goodness. So the perils of technology, cable would understand. So what we're going to talk about this week are three books. X-Men number 32, which is the only new X book that came out this week. But we also have Cable number 2 and Resurrection of Magneto number 2 held over from last week. Also, over on the main Marvel show, Jim and I talked about the new Ultimate X-Men number 1 by Peach Momoko. We both liked it, but with the proviso that it's way more of a manga kind of a story than anything a typical X-Men fan might expect from the title Ultimate X-Men. So please check that out over on that podcast or find it on the Weird Science Comics YouTube channel. So Ruben, you have something to say about Ultimate X-Men?
Yeah, actually, I loved it. It was great. But I play in both courts of traditional Western comics and manga. And
man the world, yes.
Yeah, it was not, I agree, not a story I was expecting, but I can be happy with a story that's good, even if it's not the story I expect, right?
And I agree.
It was cool. I thought it was interesting. And you know what? I actually think it'll become more X-Men over time. So
it's certainly possible.
It's
the
interesting.
Ultimate Universe, every time they add a new title, it feels, you know, bigger and more possibilities, which I like. You know, over on the DC podcast, Jim and Eric often talk about some of these worlds created for comics seem to be only created to tell one story, right? Your Superman Red Sun, there's one story. Or the Batman Gotham by Gaslight, there's kind of one story. But this new Ultimate Universe, it really seems to be set up to have lots of possibilities that it could last a long time, which would be cool. All right, we do have some news and a little bit of math. But please don't go away, just a small amount. Marvel announced last week exactly what the very final issue of the Krakoan Era will be and when it will be published. So on June 5th, 2024, Marvel will release X-Men number 35, which will also be Uncanny X-Men number 700. Which is weird, right? Because Uncanny X-Men and plain old adjectiveless X-Men are two different titles.
Yeah, I call
that
big
cheating?
Time shenanigans on that.
Shenanigans,
it's extremely
okay.
Cheating. If you were going to combine them, then I need somebody to show me that Uncanny plus regular X-Men equals 700. I'd take a bet saying that's not the case.
Let me tell you what I've come up with. So, just to recap things that longtime collectors already know, but just to set the scene, let's go back to 1963. Stan and Jack first start making this comic book about these original five, and that book was just called X-Men. That's all it said on the cover page. Then in the late 70s, the word uncanny started appearing on the covers, and into the 80s, it was like official on the legal, is it the Indicia page? Indicia? That's when it was like really officially starting to be called Uncanny X-Men. But the numbers just kept on going. They didn't reboot with a new title. They just kept on trucking, adding one more. So it's been called both things. And then things got Then things got confusing around the early 90s, and not just because I was in middle school. Starting in 1991, there were two X-Men titles, right? There was Uncanny X-Men, continuing the numbering, and then X-Men, just plain old X-Men, starting over at number one. It started off being written by Chris Claremont for like two issues, and then he was gone for reals. And then there was two books published side by side for years.
Yeah,
there's
that
a
was
stretch.
My era, so that's what I would have known. Yep.
Right. So that's what a lot of people collecting today think of as the standard way to do things. You got Uncanny, you've got X-Men, and they're two separate books. So prior to today, the most recent issue actually having Uncanny X-Men on its cover came out 1 week before House of X number one, so not that long ago. It was written by Matthew Rosenberg, was issue number 22 of that volume, but legacy number 644. So if 644 was the last issue of Uncanny we've gotten, how does Marvel justify calling this upcoming thing number 700? Well, what they're doing is counting both volumes of plain old X-Men that have been published in the Krakoan era as being issues of Uncanny X-Men. And if you count them up, and those issues that are coming, it does numerically work out. It's as if the word uncanny had been printed on all the covers in invisible ink. And in fact, when the very first Jonathan Hickman issue of X-Men was published in October of 2018, right after Hoxpox finished up, that issue actually had printed in the corner legacy number 645, which would make no sense for the X-Men title, but would make perfect sense if the plan was to call Hickman's volume Uncanny X-Men. So collectors, I don't know what to tell you. I guess you have to go to your long boxes, take out all the Hickman and Duggan issues of X-Men that you own, get a Sharpie, and write Uncanny on each and every one of those covers. It's what you got to do. It's the only way to make it make sense. Please send in some pictures. Legal disclaimer.
Yeah, I feel insulted. So I read the Jim Lee X-Men stuff. That was sort of my first foray. And then I went backwards and read, you know, the original series. But what you're telling me is that was all just a really extended miniseries.
Well, aren't they all, really, if you think about it? So, in any event, sensible or not, X-Men number 35, a.k.a. Uncanny X-Men number 700, will be the final nail in the coffin of the Krakoan era, and also, according to Marvel, a glimpse into the next era. The writers on that issue, we're told, will be Duggan, Gillen, and Ewing, from the Krakoan era. Then we get Chris Claremont telling what Marvel only calls, quote, a story of family. And then there'll be something by Gail Simone, which I take as further evidence that Simone will be either the main writer or one of the main writers of this next era. So if you're a Gail Simone fan, this is great news for you. That'll be in early June, and presumably we'll know by then for sure from solicits and things what the launch books and launch creative teams are for the next era. That's then, this is now. Time for us to talk about this week's one new book and then the two books we kicked down the road from last week. Is that enough warm, Mark Rubin? You ready to go into X-Men?
Yeah, let's do it. I just want to say this. Actually, if they give Gail Simone the reins of the main X-Men title, I mean, I'd be happy to see her have kind of a creative director role too, but if she's sort of the, you know, the flagship writer, I think I'm okay with that. She's a industry veteran and she actually tries things. And so one thing I've really been fearful of is the story just getting too basic. I know it's going to become more traditional in many ways, but I still need some, you know, new ground treaded. And I think she's somebody who could actually come up with an interesting kind of next stage story that doesn't feel like we're just retreading the past. So slightly optimistic over here.
Okay. I'm doing my best to keep an open mind on it, but I am naturally pessimistic. That's just my personality. But thank you, Ruben, for keeping my mind open. We will certainly be looking forward to seeing what Gail Simone and Tom Brevoort and whoever else comes up with down the road. But we've got some stuff to wrap up before
that. That's an East Coast mentality, according to Jim and Matt. I heard them saying that, yeah, they're miserable. And I'm positive Peter over here in the West Coast.
Well, let's see if you can be positive about this issue, which is X-Men number 32, a.k.a. Uncanny X-Men Legacy number 697, from Emma with Love.
Some people really love this. Sorry to interrupt, but yeah, some people really love this.
That's true. I've seen that on the Twitters.
I'm not sure we read the same book.
I was wondering if you were going to be one of those people.
Yeah, no, I was okay, but I was just like, people are raving about this and didn't push my buttons, I guess.
I was just going to say, it pushes some people's buttons very, very specifically. It is written by Jerry Duggan, of course, art by Phil Noto, as this whole arc has been. Letters by Clayton Cowles, design by Tom Muller and Jay Bowen. For me, this is really just a handful of Twitter bait memes kind of barely strung together. Two short scenes, one longer scene. So the short scene number one takes place on that island that has been the location of the Hellfire Gala that I can never pronounce correctly, so I'm not gonna. Orcus has just remembered, hey, we left the loose end here. There's a lighthouse keeper. He lives there. He was the one who was seen flirting with mutant fashion designer Jumbo Carnation in the Hellfire Gala issue. And in this issue, we're told that the lighthouse keeper and Jumbo, quote, traveled the world together, which is an odd thing for the sole lighthouse keeper on a rocky island to do, isn't it? I wonder how many ships sank to the bottom of the ocean while the happy couple was exploring Milan. Maybe he gets a substitute. I don't know how these things work. In any event, one cartoonishly evil unnamed Orcus goon comes to the lighthouse, threatens the life of the unnamed lighthouse keeper. Unfortunately for the goon, this lighthouse keeper is protected by Lockheed the Mini Dragon, who gleefully and just joyfully burns the goon to death with his fire breath. So how did Lockheed get here? How long has he been here? I couldn't tell you. I don't know if Jerry Duggan could tell you.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you, because they're like, the return of Lockheed. I'm like, I didn't know he was missing, but okay. Not one of my favorite characters. But
I tried to track him down. As he's been in some issues, but there's flashback issues that are set in a different era, like not part of the Krakoan era of things. He's been in some of the Marvel Unlimited, X-Men Unlimited things, which may be canon, I'm not sure. And he was definitely last on panel in a main book in that Steve Orlando Marauders volume that we both skipped. So I couldn't tell you where Lockheed is.
Okay. So something happened to the Orlando book, I'm guessing.
I guess so. Yeah. Which even that book I thought was set kind of not so much in the same timeline. Didn't they go back in time and they saw like the original mutants? I don't know. I didn't read it. I shouldn't speculate.
Yeah, I was offended when I heard that he decided to come up with like mutants before Uraki. I do not need that.
Yeah, that's why we skipped it. Once again, a lot of very happy killing in this book by characters who should be heroes. And I'm just kind of sick of that. Moving on to short scene number 2. It takes place on the streets of a town that might be New York City. Doesn't really say. First, we listen in as Emma sends a psychic recap out to her fellow mutants. The Orcus Bloom space station is destroyed. We saw that. Tony Stark is in Australia using his Sentinel Buster armor to bust almost all the remaining Sentinels, except for a few that X-Writers need to keep around for their contractually obligated fight scenes that are no longer a threat. Back in New York proper, if it is New York, Emma sees some Orcus goons arresting defenseless mutants, so she uses her Hellfire Brass Knuckle wedding present, seen in that recent Iron Man issue 2, gleefully murder those Orcus goons to death. She just vaporizes them from the waist up, so Ruben, I guess you were right, those aren't just Iron Man repulsor beams.
Yeah, they're whatever you need them to be beams.
I suppose
God, I need these things to go away very quickly. They're not cool, and they're just not cool.
And these Orcus guys, they're just gone from belt level and higher. You just see these legs lying on the ground with blood and guts coming out of them. It's not drawn as graphically as in Wolverine, but it's weirdly bloodthirsty, this issue.
They kind of don't do anything that Emma couldn't just do on her own either, right? Like, this scene to me would have been a lot cooler if you have Nasty Emma just use her mind powers and have them shoot each other, right?
Shoot each other, walk in front of a truck, jump off a building, whatever, but... they want to make her use the new toys.
It just reeks of Duggan being like, this is the coolest thing. Let me just show it, right? Just in case you're not reading Iron Man. And I didn't need to see it again.
Yes, White Queen. So our long scene now takes place in Hershey, Pennsylvania, the only town I've ever been in where the whole place smells like chocolate. Have you ever been there, Ruben? Hershey, Pennsylvania?
Nope. Does it smell like chocolate?
The whole darn town does. It has, so the Hershey factory is there and like an amusement park, and it's a touristy place. It was like in between relatives we would visit every year for Christmas, so we would often stop through. So it's a kind of neat place. Our main character here is Magic, Ilyana Rasputina, freshly returned from her Realm of X side mission, and she's not feeling too good. We know that she'd been dosed with nanites by Dr. Stasis to prevent her from being able to teleport mutants away from the Hellfire Massacre. That happened in X-Men 23. But now, without any foreshadowing that I'd noticed, those nanites seem to be killing her. Now, in Realm of X, it was kind of maybe... did we decide that her magic powers being controlled weren't nanites or were nanites? Again, these nanites can do whatever the writer needs to happen in that one particular issue with no actual continuity or stakes.
I thought she like tapped into dark magic, and that was a thing that she wasn't supposed to do, but she did anyways. I was under no impression that she was terminally ill from nanites, but here we are.
No, it's come out of nowhere. So she thinks that she's found a way to fix this, or at least to get some revenge along the way, and that is to attack Orcus's Reverend Stryker Education Center for Disadvantaged Youths, which is just a copy of the Henry Gyrich Center we've seen in New York, moved over two states into the middle of Pennsylvania. So magic kills a whole pile of Orcus goons here. Have I said that before? While pointing out, for those who might have missed it, that the whole kill no man Krakoa rule really isn't applicable anymore. I think we figured that out, Magic. We figured that out.
Yeah, let me jump in really here. This doesn't bother me as much as it's obviously bothering you, because Magic was pretty much a villain for most of her time as a X character until basically the Krakoa era. I think she had
all
some,
her
like,
Queen of Limbo situation, all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, she was quite frequently screwing people over, including her brother. So, yeah. And I guess that you could say the same thing about Emma, right? So those characters killing people, not so much.
How about,
Lockheed was weird.
How about Lockheed? Yeah.
Yeah, and then...
And Nightcrawler on that issue. If it was only the villains, I'd go, that's interesting, the reverting to type, but it's all the heroes, so I don't...
And Shadowcat, like, and Polaris, like, these are the ones where I actually am like, what the hell's going on here, right? So some of these characters, it doesn't bother me, and then others, I'm just like, this is super...
Yeah, it would be so much more interesting to me if some of them were saying, hey, we're going to go back to being the, you know, kill everybody to protect ourselves, the old Magneto kind of mindset.
Yep.
Versus let's try to actually salvage something here.
It's not well thought out, I think. You would think it would be specifically that, right? And then it would make a lot of sense, right? Like, yeah, Krakoa fell apart and these people are, you know, with the shackles off them, are going to revert back to their old personalities.
Well, that's not where we are. Where we are is one Orcus goon is found here in the process of burning evidence. Even he knows that Orcus has already lost, and in his words, quote, there are going to be trials. Which is an interesting concept that I wish was explored some more. Who's thinking about, like, what's the actual state of the world now, and how are the different villains trying to prepare for that? So he's about to shoot Magic to death, but then Kitty, a.k.a. Kate, a.k.a. Shadowcat, phases in from below, rescues her. The two ladies then rampage through the building in an orgy of bloody murder. I mean, there is so much blood. I mean, it is played for comedy how much blood is splattered all over the windows of the skyscraper. And in converse, go ahead.
I should say, yeah. This is some of the stuff, right? I understood Kitty Pryde when she was kind of enraged, right, about all of her friends getting killed. This is several times later, right? And that's the kind of stuff that I struggle with it. And in defense,
that one issue, right after the Hellfire Gala, that was cool. That made sense.
Yeah. And you could have even played it a little clever, like, what the hell did I do, right? You're a little shocked at yourself. And you could see her in a defensive situation, killing more people, right? But this seems very much on the offensive and not even necessary, right? Like, both of them, well, at least, I guess Kate can teleport for sure, right? Or phase, not teleport, but phase. Like, she could basically just walk through this whole thing without killing anyone, right? But
It's like those walkthroughs where you see people have the secret way to beat, like, Zelda in 5 minutes because you phase through the walls. That's what she could do. That's just gratuitous, both in-universe and gratuitous out-of-universe in an artistic sense. Another thing here is that, what was I going to say? Oh, right. Magic says that she's looked everywhere for mutant survivors, but not the Morlock tunnels. Now, Ruben. When mutants are under violent repression, wouldn't the first place you'd think to look be that place that mutants always go to when they're under violent repression?
Well, this just shows how crappy Magic is. She didn't want
it's
to be
just
around
to explain
those
away.
Morlocks.
Right. Oh, no, that's pretty shallow.
Too beautiful for the Morlock tunnels. She's not going to go there.
It does feel like, oh, we got to throw in something to explain away why she hasn't been seen by the other mutants. And it doesn't work. Try again, Jerry. Doesn't work. We need to add one more character to our story, and it's Polaris. She enters carrying a paper cup of coffee. Now, Polaris is one singular character trait we got. She drinks coffee all the time. I can't criticize the concept of running gags because it's kind of what I do, but this one isn't funny. Come on, let's make the coffee thing go away.
I don't know, man. I'm really connecting with that.
Representation matters, I understand.
Yes, exactly.
But yeah, it's a way here that repeatedly Duggan uses humor in the book, but he does it in a way that to me just saps any sense of danger, any suspense. Like, oh, yeah. I'm just above it all. I'm here drinking coffee, ho-hum. And it just, it's not exciting.
It's kind of horrible. You just show up and your friends have like brutally murdered everybody. You've got blood dripping in the backdrop. So you're just like, whatever, I'm just going to throw this paper cup on the ground. No biggie. These people are awful, all of them. and I've been
Which
kind
is
of
funny.
Like, I haven't really bought into that.
Right, right.
You know, the argument of like, oh, you've turned all the X-Men into like villainous characters.
That's
but
what
I'm
people said about Hickman way, way back in Hox Pox in the early time here. And now they're so much worse.
There's a thin line between a repressed minority group standing on their own 2 feet and not taking crap anymore. And then there's this. And this is just...
yeah.
Not good.
Yeah. So Polaris is here for a particular reason. She uses her mastery of magnetism to painfully rip those nanites out of Magic's body. So at least that's over. But isn't Kitty Pryde right there? And isn't Kitty's whole deal that when she phases through technology, that technology stops working?
They even referenced that with
her fight with Nimrod previously, right? How he had to come up with all these defenses against them.
Oh, yeah. Forgot about that.
Call me crazy. That seems like a much easier, less painful way of dealing with those nanites, doesn't it?
Also, master of magnetism, you'd think you could maneuver those things. I mean, we had Magneto basically, like, working his whole system, right? Like, keeping his blood flowing. This doesn't look very, like, much control in Polaris society.
Yeah, it's not
like
a delicate situation. It's just brute force. And maybe that's Polaris's thing. Maybe she's not quite a Magneto yet. But yeah, have Kitty do it. Would have been better. We end with one more Stark Sentinel battle. It's just an excuse for two more memes. First, Polaris pulls over some electrical cables while saying, "To me, my power lines."
Yeah,
which may be the worst one yet.
Yeah, it was awful. It was awful.
I'm going to write a letter to Tom Brevoort asking for him to ban the "to me, my" bit for at least the first 12 months of his tenure. Way overdone. Give it a rest for a while. It's not funny anymore.
Also, just wildly imbalanced threats again, right? Like, again, these Stark Sentinels were supposed to be tough as hell, and now you can just stick a sword in their head and jam some, you know, power cords, and that's good enough to take them out.
Exactly. They're not scary anymore.
I don't know why they're ever scary. I mean, we even have, like, Kitty Pryde here just cutting some exposed wires in their feet. Like, this is really what the Stark Sentinels are. This is their threat. It feels like
we're just on the downhill slope of this arc. So we don't have time for that anymore. Now the mutants are winning. Therefore, the mutants are winning. In a little circular logic.
I just don't think Duggan is that clever with this. And it feels like he did the same thing to Nimrod, right? Like, he's just had robots get smashed pretty easily, and he doesn't seem to
make
them
that threatening. Same thing has been done. I'm not sure by it was Duggan exactly, but by Omega Sentinel, she was so cool and so threatening. And then she gets knocked out twice in a row by nobodies. We got one more meme to deal with, and that's delivered by Emma, who drives up and does the Mean Girls meme, telling Kitty and Magic to get in. We're killing the fascists. And I know you're not on Twitter anymore, Ruben. Smart you. But that has been all over Twitter. Super popular. Ha ha. She said, get in. We're killing fascists. And yeah, it's fine on Twitter, I guess. It doesn't advance the story, and it makes Emma look very lame. So, how do we wrap this thing up? Lockheed's joined the party here in Hershey. How'd he get there? When? It doesn't matter. We just need a panel of everybody snuggling the dragon, which is not a euphemism. And Cyclops psychically radios in to remind us that he's still alive, which I don't know if this is the first time all the X-Men find out that he wasn't actually executed. And he tells them, oh, that whole Dr. Gregor exists, and she's kind of on our side now. So I guess next issue is going to deal with Nimrod and also with Dr. Devo and maybe Dr. Gregor. I hope that one's better than this one. The cover of the next issue also features those Latverian mutants from the Doctor Doom issue, which could be fun. I'm struggling with the optimism after this one, but I'm trying to say, yeah, we liked them last time we saw them, so maybe they'll be good again. But this issue, not so much fun. I've got no problem with the Phil Noto art. You know his art. We know his art. If you love it, you love it. If you don't, you don't. I think he does his usual quality job. But the story, and especially the dialogue, just do less than nothing for me. I know lots of people enjoy this issue a lot more than I did. Even in the Slack, Get Fresh Crew member Softboy said he was just happy to see Magic and Kitty together. Now, I haven't been reading X-Men comics most of my life like some people, so nostalgia for these kind of pairings, it just doesn't I don't have that button installed, right? That's not my thing. So if you enjoy that nostalgia, you can get more pleasure out of this. Good for you. I just thought every attempt at a joke here made me like it less, and Jerry Duggan's humor doesn't work for me. It's not quite as painful as, like, maybe Mark Russell's humor, but it's kind of down in that neighborhood. So I have to give this issue a 4.5 out of 10. Pretty bad, maybe the worst one I've read for a long time. Ruben, are you as pessimistic and negative as me, or not quite?
Yeah, no, I didn't like it. I thought I was going to be the negative guy, though. I'm just going to give it a few five. I mean, it makes me angry. Gotcha. Yeah, it makes me angry. It's just not good. And it's generic.
Such a shame.
It feels extremely rushed. And I just have a hard time dealing with this when we've got like a really good kind of thoughtful, deep story with, you know, Karen's side of the kind of closing days of this. And it's super hard to like rationalize it because they're kind of like intertwined. But you've got a book that takes it all seriously, and then you get, and then so I'm all excited, and then I'm like, and then, oh yeah, this. It just really drags down the other story too, which sucks.
I think that one of my big problems with this side of the story is that there's been no dramatic arc, right? Around the time of Fall of the House of X number one, Orcus looked unbeatable. Have all of Earth over a barrel. They've got these unbeatable Stark Sentinels. How in the world can our plucky underdogs possibly win? And then cut to now, Orcus seems they're already beaten. They're already giving up. They're barely a threat. But there was no dramatic turning point. We yada-yadded over the best part. Maybe the chronologically confused publishing schedule is partly to blame, right? Books are coming out of order, which certainly can't help with the whole dramatic tension. Maybe months from now, somebody's going to put together a Fall of the House of X event reading order with every issue in its proper place. And maybe there the arc will feel more like an arc. But right now, it's not an arc. It's just a flop. But it's just not great. Well, I think we've beaten this one to death. If I had a ding sound effect, I would ring it. There we go. And we're moving on to Cable number. Oh, Ruben, you got more to say.
I have to say one last thing. I just want to read, so to your point, right? Like how bad Duggan's characterization of Orcus is. So we've got, you know, Avengers number 11, and we've got this line from Tony. You know,
Yeah, tell us about that. I didn't read that book yet.
Yeah, so he's like, look, there's a lot of moving parts in this operation, and you know as well as I do, we only have one shot at this, really, because it seems like they're completely, you know, pushovers. Krakoa fell, and they had hundreds of top-class mutants. There are only seven of us. I'm the engineer. I'm good at moving parts, so you can trust me to call the play. And right now, we can't do this. I'm like, seriously? It seems like anybody can just sneeze and push Orcus over, right? Like, the freaking Avengers. Does. Like, if, you know, Lockheed and Kitty Pryde can basically
right. then Captain
take on
Marvel.
An entire prison. Right. Yeah. Yeah, bring in Thor and Captain Marvel. And I mean, this only works if all the stuff that is formidable, right? Like, you've got to have Stark Sentinels that actually can wreck house. And you need villains that are not idiots, right? That can, you know, they're agile and able to deal with, you know, evolving threats. And we kind of had none of that.
Yeah, that's a good point. And not this current issue of Avengers, but I think the next two issues are officially tie-ins to Fall of the House of X. And Ruben, you and I are going to cover those on this podcast. So yeah, we'll definitely come back to talk about that next time, or, you know, next time they come up. So now we're really going to move on to Cable number 2, Stone Cold, written by Fabian Nicieza, pencils by Scott Eaton and Lan Medina, inks by Cam Smith with Victor Nava, and colors and letters by someone I didn't write down. Oh, here it is. Hava Tartaglia is the colors, and Joe Sabino on the letters, with Tom Muller and Jay Bowen on design. So we said we were going to cover this, so here I am. But I don't really have a whole lot to say about it. It's become entirely clear. This series has absolutely nothing to do with the going on in the other books. Might as well be one of those throwback books set in a different era, like the recent Storm and Gambit books by Anna Senti and Chris Claremont. But for what it is, it's fine, right?
It has two good jokes, in my opinion, and that'll make my score a little bit higher. But it is also a little difficult for me to read this, where it's like, it just feels like they're like, that Orcus, I don't want to deal with that, right? Like, let's deal with this more threatening threat, except again, there seems to be no tension or likelihood that they're not just going to be able to completely overwhelm.
Yeah, they do throw the word Orcus and Krakoa into the dialogue here and there, but it almost feels like those were added, you know, as it was on its way to print, just to make it look like it was more connected.
I will say, Grey Gargoyle, as a character that allows you to make jokes, he's now way up there on my list. Because we
That's
had
an
the,
okay thing, yeah.
You know, we had the pretty hilarious conversation about what his power was, touching things and making it hard. And this issue we have, oh no, he got me stoned and now I'm so hungry. And I was like, okay, that's pretty funny. I mean, it's it's very juvenile, but I thought it was a well-played joke there.
Yeah, it really seems like Fabian Nyssa-Iza here really likes going through some of the fandom wiki pages for some really obscure characters, right? So we had the Grey Gargoyle, and Cable wins against him by using his techno-organic MacGuffin to turn Gargoyle back to human form. Oh, and by the way, young Cable was turned to stone in between issues.
That's the part, yeah.
That's weird.
Well, in between issues, and also he freaking has the techno-organic virus too, and the whole point of this is like, oh, I can't turn old man Cable into stone because, you know, the TK virus like overrides it, right?
Maybe so it's like what we said with Magneto and Polaris, like young Cable doesn't have the mastery over it yet to do what old Cable can. Yeah, I'm going to try to localize it.
It should have been spelled out better because I was like, really? Like, this is the exact same thing, but works on one guy and it doesn't on the other. I did think it was pretty funny, though, when Grey Gargoyle's whole fight was like, this is the best job I've had, you jerks.
Like, that was kind of funny. Yeah.
Criminal. I'm tired of getting punched. That whole part was hilarious to
There's
me. I'm like, oh, yeah.
Kind of a funny running thing going on where old man Cable says, oh, this threat is coming. I got to stop it now. And the people who are working for Parvenu, I think is the name of the company, like Grey Gargoyle says, you know, they're not even close to achieving this bad thing. They're just kind of chugging along. They're not even breaking the law, which at least Grey Gargoyle points out, but Cable just comes in and wrecks them anyway.
He likes those stock options. He's like, he just wants his stock and
well, those stock
steady
options
paycheck
best, sure.
and some medical, right? Like, that's all he needs. And I did think it was pretty hilarious when he lost his Grey Gargoyle powers and he's, you know, just shows how dumb the look is, where he's like in tidy whities, basically, in the, you know, overalls and
very
flush skin. Yeah. So all of that worked for me. I thought that part was pretty good. But
did you like having a lunch scene again at a very specific restaurant?
Yeah, I was like,
are we going to get one of those every issue?
Yeah, is that a real restaurant too?
I don't think it gave us a name for this one. Or at least I didn't look it up the way I did last time. But they do have conch fritters and key lime pie there in the Florida Keys, which I don't think any of the other action is in the Florida Keys. So we know they can body slide by whatever to go wherever they want.
Yeah, they're just hungry.
It means that maybe Nyssa-Iza just wanted to go to the Florida Keys for this restaurant and then send them back.
Yeah. He didn't get the clearance, though, like he did for the first one. So they had to delete the name.
Or didn't give, you're not giving me a discount? Screw you, I'm taking your name out. We get an introduction to another obscure old character. This is Jonathan Chambers, a.k.a. Imperium.
Yeah.
And when I say obscure, I mean obscure. Although, when I did describe him to our old buddy Chris Sheehan, he came up with Imperium first guess because he's amazing.
Yeah.
But Imperium has been in exactly 6 comic book issues before this one, and 4 of those 6 were promotional comics you could only get by buying a kid's meal at Hardee's. So other than that, only 2 issues. One was an annual. So Imperium's deal is that he feeds on pain and negative emotions, turns them into energy. And Parvenu has Imperium all chained up against his will, using this ability to power whatever creepy stuff they're up to, which explains why Imperium wasn't able to make it to Krakoa, which, again, is one of those little minor mentions in the dialogue about Krakoa that I think were built in at the last minute.
Yeah, it worked, but it also helps you explain, you know, we were wondering, like, where the heck did they get all this mutant DNA, right, for this group, and they talked about how, you know, back in, and I'm not familiar with this character, but it seemed like there was a period of time when people were sending mutants to this person to get some help with the, maybe it's the legacy virus or one of the other mutant killing viruses. Mm-hmm. So it's like he would have had an opportunity to do a lot of DNA sampling. So I was like, okay, that kind of explains where you got all these DNA samples of mutants.
Yeah. And they also have, we don't even see them on panel, but apparently Parvenu has a bunch of energy related mutants kind of all trapped and used for power. And let's see, here's the list of names. Absinthe with a Y, Digitech, Go Devil, Lightmaster, Lawrence Rambo, The Nameless Mass, Sparks, Suede, Veil, and X-Ray. I don't recognize any of those, but I'm sure lots of people got, like, off of one or two of them, that nostalgia hit. And, you know, I think that's what this book is going for. So if you enjoyed it, good for you. One more obscure old character comes out. Turns out the secret head of Parvenu Industries is Amanda Muller, a.k.a. the Black Womb, a Fabian Nicieza character from his Gambit series that ran right around the year 2000. She's tied in with that genetics group at Alamogordo, the same group that included Professor X and Mr. Sinister, among others. So that's kind of cool. Again, I'd never heard of her.
I got some real, like, why do I know this character? And I didn't read that Gambit series, so when I did the wiki thing, I was like, that doesn't make sense. But I'm pretty sure Kieran might have shown her in one of the panels when Sinister was with Xavier at Alamogordo.
It makes me want to look back at that one issue of Immortal X-Men where we kind of flashed back to there and see if she's in the background somewhere.
Yeah, I think she is. That's where it registered for me. And she's got the crappiest mutant power ever. It's like immortality, but her body ages. Which I was like, oh, that blows.
That's a Greek myth, isn't it? Isn't that the one guy who ended up getting turned into a cricket? Because he had a favor from a god. He asked for immortal life or eternal life, but didn't ask for eternal youth. So he got all shriveled up like she does and eventually got turned into a cricket. Oh, well. So this story, again, it's not a bad comic, but it's aimed at Fabian Nicieza fans and other readers who are really into the 1990s X books, which just isn't me. It's not a bad book. It's just not at all connected to what I want out of the X books right now. I want to know what's going on with Orcus. I want to see what's going on with the Moira stuff. I want to see what's going on with the timelines. I don't need a side adventure of two Cables kind of fighting generic 90s bad guys. I'm just not here for that.
Yeah, and this could be a book for me, but I would need it to be a lot more Cable-centric. Although the jokes are funny, it does seem like, I'm sort of like, why are there two Cables, right? But even the first battle with Grey Gargoyle, it's like, feels like old Cable could have just handled that entirely on his own.
Yeah, we don't get the banter or the relationship between the two of them like we've seen in some other books.
Yeah, and if that was played up a little bit more, I'd be more interested in seeing what's going on, right? Because I could say, okay, that plotline is interesting to me. I'd be like, okay, I don't need you to fight Orcus. I can deal with the fact that it's the side quest, but then what am I getting out of this, right? And it has to be more than just seeing obscure villains and Nicieza creations. So, I don't know. But I enjoyed reading it more. It was kind of a nothing story. So, for me, this is just a solid six. Just if you're into it, get it. If you're not, skip it. You're not missing anything. But
yeah, I think at this point,
anger me.
Listeners, you know if you're in the target audience for this book, right? There's you know if this is for you, you should buy it. If it's not for you, don't worry about it. And I know, Ruben, you're going to keep reading it. So if anything comes up that is suddenly out of nowhere super relevant to Krakoa, you're going to let us know. But I'm going to give it a score that I just made up on the spot. I'm going to give this a sayonara 7 because I'm not going to read it anymore, but no hard feelings.
Yeah, maybe it should be sayonara 6 because I feel like 7's a little in the realm of...
I'm feeling generous. I'm going to give it a full sayonara 7.
Okay.
And now it is time to go on to our final book of this episode as I scroll down my notes document, and that is Resurrection of Magneto, number 2 of 4, The Weight of the World, written by our friend Al Ewing, art by Luciano Vecchio, colors by David Curiel and Jesus Abertov, letters by Joe Sabino, and there's no design by this time, which is weird because issue 1 had our usual Tom Muller and Jay Bowen, but they get left off this issue for some reason. That tends to happen in Al Ewing books. There was a stretch of this podcast where I was way into the conspiracy theory about why they weren't credited on Al Ewing books, and just weird to see them left off this time. I'm sure it's just an oversight. So in the first issue of this title, we followed Storm as she found her way into and then through a version of the afterlife heavily inflected by concepts and symbols from Kabbalah and from the tarot card deck. In this issue, our focus character is Magneto, and the narration bubbles are populated with his thoughts. The issue starts somewhere I did not expect to ever see again. It retells an incident between Magneto and Namor, first seen in giant-size X-Men Magneto from the year 2000. Now, Ruben, did you read those kind of off-to-the-side, artist-focused books that came out in that stretch?
Yeah. It must not have been 2000 then. It must have been like 2010.
What 2020 is what I said. I meant to say here.
Yes.
Sorry about that.
Yes, yeah. I did.
So, yep. Yeah. So it was, there was ones about, I think the main kind of through line was Storm got infected by something and had to be healed.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
This one was written by Jonathan Hickman, the Magneto one, art
isn't
by
where
Ramon
Mike
Perez.
Cody's Island got created in one of them.
Yes, this is where it didn't get created, but Magneto had to like purchase or trade for the island from Namor.
Yeah, and he built the castle thing for Emma.
Right. Well, this wasn't Krakoa. This is where the Hellfire Gala took place. So
yeah.
The Hellfire Galas aren't actually on Krakoa. It's on this island off to the side.
Yeah. In any event, yeah, I recall that. He built the whatever structure was on that island for the whoever.
So this scene and most of the dialogue is taken directly from that issue. Namor asks Magneto to help him find out what happened to a team of Atlantean explorers who disappeared down a trench. That's like the trade to get the island. They wind up in this cave with the three half-octopus ladies in three columns. They tell Namor, pick one of the objects. His choice will determine if you live or die. It looks like there's only two choices. Namor chooses poorly and gets a nautilus-looking animal stuck to his face, kind of suffocating him to death. Doesn't he have gills? But anyway, it's not working out well for him. Magneto chooses a hidden key that he wasn't even supposed to notice, which is where this issue picks up. In this issue, the two columns behind Octopus Lady have Krakoan letters on them, which is weird because the place they were at in giant-sized Magneto had nothing to do with Krakoa, was way older than that language. But I mean, right now we're in Magneto's mind in the afterlife, so sure, license is fine. The Krakoan letters here are B and J, get your mind out of the gutter. They make this whole splash page a reference to the tarot card called the High Priestess, where it has like the actual letters B and J referencing Boaz and Jachin, the towers of the Temple of Solomon. Again, if you're a tarot guy, you'd say, oh yeah, I recognize that, but I'm sure this is symbolism for something. I don't really get it.
I don't either. That's interesting though. I didn't know that.
Yeah, Twitter is used for some things. I had asked on Twitter, hey, anybody know why these letters are here? And somebody I've never met, I should have written down his name because it was very helpful, pointed out, oh, it's a reference to this particular tarot card. And okay, that continues at least the symbolism we've been getting. So as a reward for making the correct choice, Magneto gets to keep the key he chose, and also the Nautilus stops killing Namor. So that's good. In the Hickman story, the Octopus Lady says to Magneto, trickster. Fraud, liar, thief. Do you have any idea what you've done? Do you care at all what this does? Meaning the key. And Magneto says, no, I do not. In this issue, Ewing adds a bit more dialogue. Octopus Lady says to Magneto about the key, once you have it, you can never lose it, even in death, which is handy here in the afterworld, until the day it is turned. It is the key to the door of judgment and purification. Magneto asks, the door out or the door in? And Octopus Lady says, turn it and see. Is this key going to be important at the end of the issue? I think so. So the rest of this issue is mostly Magneto confronting the vast number of names around him. We saw those name-covered walls at the end of the last issue. A few of them get highlighted here. These are Elizabeth Elaine, who's an evil murderer that Magneto killed in 2014, Doug Ramsey, who died in New Mutants number 60 during the time when Magneto was headmaster, not killed by Magneto, but like under his watch, under his care. We've got Susanna Dane, who's Polaris's mother, who died in a plane crash when Polaris's powers first manifested. And we've got Michael Columbus, who was the one-eyed mutant known as Basilisk. He was killed by Zorn with an X, when Zorn with an X was pretending to be Magneto. So the list here is very, very broad. Not just people who Magneto killed directly, but those he in any way helped to cause to die or didn't, in his mind, sufficiently protect. So this is kind of subtle for a comic book, but I think the idea here is to depict Magneto as his main sin really being excessive pride, hubris. He thinks that he should have saved everybody. That it was his duty, he was strong enough to save everybody, and he didn't. So he's punishing himself for all these people, even the ones where there's no logical reason to blame himself, just because he thinks everything is about him. Which is kind of a cool way to look at Magneto's character. Whenever he's a good guy or a bad guy, he thinks that it's all about him. And this is why he resists Storm's call to come back to the world of the living. He doesn't want to lose his spot as the greatest sinner in the history of the world. He wants to continue obsessing on his own sins. Magneto's own name is there too, Max Eisenhart. He is also his own victim. So what do you think, Ruben? Am I reading too much into this, or do you think that's what's really going on here, as I have some tea?
No, you're pretty dialed into it. I think there's some deep cuts here, which is interesting, and you could really invest in this. But it was a bit much for me. It was a little too much like pandering to like this idea of him like wrestling with his past sins and maybe coming around to like, I'm also my own victim.
Yeah. There's like a subtlety that is kind of underneath, but on top of that is a whole lot of not subtle. So the first time I read it, I was kind of just, the not subtle stuff was just too much for me. But when I read it a couple more times, I was starting to see, okay, maybe there's more going on here. And in fact,
it did annoy me, but I just didn't engage with it, I guess is the way I want to say that. So there's a lot of text and a lot of stuff, and I'm like, oh, it's all probably stuff that he killed a bunch of people and felt guilty about it. It's kind of cool hearing you go into like the details of who these people are. And there's a bit more, but it didn't intrigue me enough to engage with it.
So this reminds me of a book that I read decades ago. The book is called The Great Divorce. It was written by C.S. Lewis, you know, the Narnia guy. So The Great Divorce is a deeply symbolic Christian allegory told in the form of a dream. In this dream, the spirits of dead people are trapped in a place called the Grey Town, a place of punishment not too far outside of heaven. Maybe it's hell, maybe it's purgatory. But the thing is, they're not really trapped at all. At any time, they could get on this bus and go to heaven. It's nice that the afterlife has, you know, good public transportation. But they always talk themselves out of it. Oh, I'm not ready yet, or they're too proud to admit they were wrong, or they just can't bear to leave their sins behind to go to heaven. It's a really good book, and I think Al Ewing has read it. At least I'm seeing very strong echoes of it in the way he's has Magneto here. So if he was going to be on like X-Men Monday on Aped, on whatever that website is called, Adventures of Poor Taste, I would ask Al Ewing, have you read The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis?
The bits I really liked was less of Magneto and his guilt, which was sort of the center of this. But yes. I got more out of like Storm trying to get him out of his funk and her compassion. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And as much as I normally kind of get sick of, you know, Storm the perfect person kind of trope, she actually was pretty compassionate here. And I related more to that and thought, oh, yes, pretty cool. Like, she's a damn good friend to go into the afterlife and, you know, try to.
That's pretty devoted, yeah.
Yeah, get him out.
Yeah, so she shows him another list of names, a list of all the names of people that Magneto has saved, which, you know, a little on the nose, a little too Schindler's List-y kind of thing, but no, it works here. She convinces Magneto to take out that key. I told you it'd be important. He takes out the key, he holds it just out into the air, and he turns it. And here there's a twist. They don't step back out into the world of the living. It's only issue two. No, the floor disappears below them, and they fall downwards. They end up somewhere dark and very cold. Super creepy artwork here, like teeth in the darkness. Really, really cool looking, very, very disturbing looking in a good way. A voice in black word bubbles taunts them. The book ends with that voice saying, "Oh, my dear Magneto, you might as well fight your own shadow." So this is the Shadow King, right? Or am I reading too much of it? It's got to be the Shadow King, right?
Yeah, it has to be. That was my assumption.
So the Shadow King, of course, is that ancient primal force that in the X-Men books usually is occupying the mutant Amal Farouk, but is really a separate entity from him. It's like this, been around forever, super powerful, creepy psychic thing. What does he have to do with any of this? I have no idea, but the art sure looks awesome. Yeah, I found this to be a more straightforward narrative than we got in the first issue. At least maybe I'm just more used to it. I know what to expect now. Still deeply symbolic, easier to follow.
It was a little more straightforward, more of a path. And there is, I don't know if it's exactly a cliffhanger because I don't know what the Shadow King's going to do, but as a cool idea, like, you bring back Magneto, but he's now the host of the Shadow King. That'd be kind of interesting. Not what I was expecting.
Yeah, that would be interesting. One thing I wanted to ask you about is, we get some talk about Toad here. Now, Toad had a very strange character arc in the Trials of Magneto series, the series that set up the whole waiting room gimmick. Now, here it acknowledges that Toad, he got pulled into the pit. He admitted that he did this murder that he didn't actually do, right? The killing of Scarlet Witch. And I never understood what Leah Williams was trying to do there, whether it was a mistake or I was just too dumb to follow it. But here, Magneto acknowledges that, oh, this was a thing that happened, had to happen so that the waiting room could be created. Can you tell me what really is going on here with Toad? Because I'm still confused.
No, it's necessary. Yeah. I mean, the thing about Toad is he's like been a sycophant for Magneto forever, right? And sure. So I'm guessing this is just another guilt moment where he's like, I was there. This guy vouched that he killed, you know, somebody to try to cover for me, and I didn't like prevent it.
I guess, but it seems to be more than that. They're trying to set something up with Toad. I think he's trying to fix this problem, and I don't quite get it still. Because Scarlet Witch, she arranged for her own death because that's what had to happen for the waiting room to be created. So then why didn't she speak up and say, oh, by the way, Toad, he didn't actually do anything. How about we let him out of the pit? Because as far as we know, Toad is still inside the pit down there with, I guess, Doug Ramsey's still there. Toad never came out and joined the Exiles, I don't think. No, so we don't know what's up with Toad.
Did the numbers above the heads of the Exiles mean anything to you?
Oh, let's see.
There's a flashback scene back to where...
That. Oh, yeah, I remember that. Those were the numbers of the laws that they broke.
Oh, got it.
Right? Okay. I forget which was which. The kill no man, respect this holy land.
So that's a three, not an eight.
And the third one.
Sense. Yeah, got it.
We did see that in one of the Exiles books from one of the Sabretooth books there. So that's what was going on there.
That helps. So I was looking at it, I was like, I thought that was an 8. I was like, 18282? What is
it? 867-5309? Yeah. Oh, it's Jenny. Nice. But yeah, this was a pretty cool issue. I enjoyed the symbolism more here. I think there's probably a lot of Kabbalah and Tarot symbolism I just missed. At least I didn't see nearly as much as in the first issue. The emotional battle here inside Magneto, we got a cool turning point where he didn't want to come back to life. And right, he always said at the beginning, that's why he erased his own backup. He was saying, I'm not going to come back. But when Storm shows him that, you know, stuff's really gone wrong for Charles, especially, and for the mutants in general, he does have that mental emotional change. Okay, I'm ready to try to come back now. So these next two issues are going to be him working actively towards coming back, and that could be fun. I don't think this is the definitive Magneto story that some people online are calling it, but it's a strong illumination of one critical aspect of his character, and I like that. So I'm going to give this, I'll call it an 8 out of 10. It's a good issue.
Yeah, you're higher than I am. I'm just at a 7, but yeah, but I did enjoy it. The art's beautiful, and there's a lot more depth to this story than I gave it credit. Yeah, I kind of just like read through it and was like, oh, that's some interesting stuff. But I do think it's really cool to tie back to things like those giant size issues that we read and give them more meaning, because a lot of those issues, I was like, they look cool, but there's nothing happening in them.
Right. The way they were sold, at least, was as artists, you know, ways for an artist to show off, right? They called them these big name artists, each book had a different artist, and it was more about doing some cool things with the colors and the lines. So I did not expect to see that key in that scene from Giant Size Magneto ever come back. And I'm really curious if Hickman intended that key to be something like this, or if this is just Ewing picking up on that and saying, heck, I can make something out of that. Why not?
And I really appreciate the like Storm Magneto friendship. That's really just been one of Ewing's kind of signature stories. But he just does a really good job here with it, and makes me think they have a deep friendship, right? And
yeah, I buy it.
I hope people continue with that. And I am now dreading, like, if he gets possessed by Shadow King. And I guess that would give you, like, a reason for him to go back to being evil Magneto.
That could be our way to reset him to his ground state. And it's kind of weird because in Ultimate X-Men number 1, the Peach Momoko book, the villain there reminded me of the Shadow King as well. They don't say the name, kind of like they do here, but Jim and I both said, we think that villain is sort of kind of maybe an Ultimate Universe version of the Shadow King. So it's kind of funny to see it pop up the same week in another issue, if that is what's going on. So those are the books that we had to talk about this week. What's going on next week? Well, I did not write down these notes, so let me scroll through Comixology right now. For next week, Marvel, sort by price ascending. Okay, here we go. We've got Fall of the House of X number 3 with Jerry Duggan. Let's hope that really makes us feel like there's more drama going on.
This is bad news. Like, shows you how bad his writing is these days. I'm not I'm not looking forward to that. I will read it. I have to read it, but at this point, I don't want to read it. Yes.
We do have Dead X-Men number 3, which seems pretty quick for that to come out, but we've been enjoying that one. That was where the team suddenly took it on themselves to go to Moira's previous actual lives and not just the Moira engine lives. So, and that's the one with the Moira with the big old axe trying to go back in time. So there's going to be some cool stuff going on there. And we've got Wolverine number 45, because we've got the Sabretooth War coming pretty much every other week. And it looks like those are our 3 books next week. So not a bad number. I think that's about the right number of books for us to talk about. Fall of the House of X number 3, Dead X-Men number 3, and Wolverine number 45. So that is what we're going to talk about next time. Yes, Ruben?
2 of those I'm looking forward to, and it's sort of shocking to me which 2 of those are.
Yeah, and the other one is the big event book. So, again, trying to be optimistic, keep my mind open, hoping there'll be something really cool that Jerry Duggan has waiting for us in that Fall of the House of X number 3. But while we wait for those books to come out, Ruben, what do you think our loyal listeners can do in the meantime?
They go look for those Hardy's issues and then read more X-Men comics.
Hardy's issues. That sounds good. You know, Hardy's always puts their burgers on some.
You're a real crumb bum.
Crumb bums. Okay, see you next time, everybody. Bye.